This is part 2 of chapter 2, and in this part we'll talk about other estate planning documents. Now, I mentioned site instruction letters before. This is going to give a detailed disposition of specific tangible possessions. Now, these may not be things of high value that you would put a specific bequest in your will for, but this might be your personal property. You know, who do you want to have your golf clubs and so forth? And this is something that may change periodically as your personal property changes. So you wouldn't necessarily want this to go in your will. But you can make reference in your will that you want your personal property disposed of according to the side letter of instructions.
Right. Some states have specific statutes that allow a personal property memorandum to be used, mm-hmm. where you put in the will a clause that says, I intend to leave a memo at death disposing of personal property. And then you leave this memo and it says, my golf clubs go to Sam and my gold watch goes to Harry and things of that sort. You can change those personal property memoranda at any time and you don't have to worry about the will itself. Mm-hmm. So it's a very efficient way of dealing with a will.
The other thing that the side letter of instructions can do will be to express your concerns concerning your funeral and burial arrangements. I think this is a really important thing to put in the side letter of instructions because when a loved one dies, the family members are grieving and they're immediately forced into having to make a lot of decisions about the funeral and about the burial and would you want to be cremated or would you want to be buried and do you want to be buried back in your home state or do you want to be buried where you were when you died and so forth. And it can cause a lot of tension between the surviving family members when they have different opinions as to what they think you would want. So you can avoid all of the problems by just putting it there in your side letter of instructions.
There are several statutory provisions that do affect wills. One is called forced heirship, and there are actually a couple of different types of this. In the United States, we only deal with one type of forced heirship rule, and that involves the spouse. But in some countries, forced heirship also requires you to leave a certain portion of your estate to your children. And even if you cut the children out, they could go to court and they could get a piece of your estate when you die. So we don't have to worry about that in the U.S. You can cut out your children if you want to, but you can't cut out your spouse. Now, what about the marital portion? What is the spouse entitled to? Well, this depends on state law. You have to go back to those intestacy statutes and elective share provisions under state law. But in most states, the spouse is entitled to anywhere between one-third and one-half of your probate estate. So if I leave a will that leaves $1 to my dear wife, and she's not happy with that bequest, she could elect against the will, and then she could walk away from that proceeding with between one-third and one-half of my estate. So it's very, very difficult to cut out the spouse. The only way, really, to do it is divorce, but that's not going to be a valid estate planning option.
Right. Now, a felonious homicide statute will prevent any legatees or heirs who have been convicted of intentionally killing the decedent from inheriting under the decedent's will or through intestacy. You might want to explain this to your children, who may be tempted when they find out how much life insurance you have to knock you off and collect the life insurance. Now, a divorce statute will invalidate a provision in a will that leaves assets to a former spouse. It often happens that people have their wills drawn up, and then they go through a divorce, and they don't change their wills. So they might be leaving, you know, half of their property or all of their property to their ex-spouse. Well, the court understands that you didn't really intend to leave it to someone that you're no longer married to, so it will invalidate that provision. But what this means to you is that if you really do want to leave some property to an ex-spouse, you need to make sure that that provision is clearly stated in the will.
This provision is a general rule that applies in most states, but some states don't have these divorce statutes. So if you practice in a state where no divorce statute exists and there's a bequest to a person who is now a former spouse in the will, you better change the will if you don't want that person to get that property. Mm-hmm. So as a general rule, you can use this, but make sure when you're practicing, you know what the rules are in your state. Now, an anti-lapse statute is a state-created presumption that allows the property to go to somebody who the testator probably intended the property to go to if somebody dies in the interim. Now, let me give you a quick example. Let's say that I pass away, but I left my beach house to my brother. And my brother died before I did, so he's not there to take the beach house. His gift under my will would have lapsed because he's no longer there to take. He can't take it. So if the state has an anti-lapse statute, statute, what would happen is that beach house would then go to my brother's children, because there'd be a presumption that if the person I left the property to was not alive, that I'd really want it to go to their heirs, because that's what would have happened if I died first and then the beneficiary died. So an anti-lapse statute just creates a legal presumption that allows the property to pass to specific beneficiaries instead of the residuary estate.
In certain circumstances, you might be a little bit more vulnerable to a will contest, and that often happens in non-traditional relationships. The family members might get upset when they find that you left everything to the person you'd been living with instead of leaving it to your family, and they could contest the will. So there are some other planning strategies that you will probably want to use if you are in a non-traditional relationship. Something else that you can do to avoid a will contest would be to just be open with your heirs before death. Talk about your intentions, bring it to the table, discuss it, make sure that they understand what you want to do and why you want to do it. And that may help alleviate some of the conflict. Of course, you want to have a well-drafted will, and this is probably the best protection you can have to discourage will contests. If your will is not properly drafted, then you're open to will contests.
If you really do anticipate a will contest, one way to avoid that is not to use a will, not to pass property through the probate process, because the will contest applies to the property passing through that transfer vehicle. So we can use other options like lifetime gifts. We can have trusts in place before we die. Maybe we'll use a revocable living trust that will put all the property into that and then have that trust govern the disposition of the property after we die. Or we could use property titling, things like joint tenancy with right of survivorship, because that'll pass the property automatically at death without going through probate. So the will contest itself, remember, only applies to the probate assets. So if we can find a way to transfer the assets outside of the probate process, we don't have to worry about the will contest. Another alternative would be to validate the will before you die, and this is an option in some states. It's not the majority rule, but some states you can actually take your will to the probate court and validate it so that it will be automatically admissible into court, and the court finds that you were competent at the time you validated the will. So this will help avoid the will contest, because the only thing a will contest can do is challenge your capacity to make the will. They can't challenge what you did. What you did is a function of your planning, and nobody can tell you how to do your own planning. If you validate the will, the court will decree before you die that you had the capacity to make the will and that the will met all the requirements necessary to be admitted to probate.
Another one of the documents that you'll have in your estate plan will be a power of attorney. And a power of attorney is a legal document that authorizes another person, a trusted person, to act on your behalf. There are different types of powers of attorney. You can either give a general power of attorney, which is very broad, or a limited power of attorney, which is for a specific purpose. A general power of attorney will allow your attorney, in fact, to appoint property to himself, his creditors, his estate, or the creditors of his estate. So essentially, he is given the power to make any decision that he wants to with what to do with this property. But one thing you need to be warned of is that when you give someone that type of power, then any property over which he has that power will be included in his gross estate. A limited power of attorney, on the other hand, is very specific. It could be for a specific activity or power over a specific property, or it could be a fairly general power but that has some limitations that will keep it out of the person's gross estate. What you need to remember with a power of attorney, though, is that it does not survive the death of the principal, the person who creates the power of attorney. This document works up until the point of death, but not after the point of death. And so this document is typically used for any situation in which you're not going to be able to act for yourself, including incapacity.
Right. Your attorney, in fact, will act until you die, and once you die, your executor or executrix takes over.
Mm-hmm. Now, you don't necessarily have to be incapacitated to use a power of attorney. People use them all the time if they're going to be out of town traveling, need to let their spouse sell the house for them or sell a car or whatever. You can give this power of attorney for any number of reasons. There are some differences between a power of attorney and a power of appointment. So the two seem very similar, and it can be difficult when you're first learning about them to understand what the differences are. So let's go through some of the differences right now. First of all, a power of attorney refers to a document. It's a standalone document that allows the agent to act for the principal and may include a power of appointment over assets. A power of appointment, however, it's not a document, it's a power that's usually included in a power of attorney or in a trust, allowing the power holder to direct assets to another. So a power of attorney is a power to act, and a power of appointment is simply a power to transfer assets. The power of attorney will end at the death of the principal, whereas a power of appointment may survive the death of the grantor. So you see this in trusts, especially. And the trusts do survive and the powers do survive after the death of the grantor.
One specific example that we saw a little bit earlier, and we will see again later in the course, is the general power of appointment trust that we use to get the marital deduction. That gives typically the spouse a power of appointment at death to transfer the assets. So that would be an example of a trust where that power of appointment actually survives the death of the person who holds it.
Now, both can be either general or limited, and both can be revoked at any time by the principal.
When we say general or limited, I just want to make sure everybody has this concept, because this is an important one, particularly when we get to the tax consequences. General means you can appoint to yourself or to a proxy for yourself, so it will be yourself, to your estate, your creditors, or the creditors of your estate. So if you have the right to appoint to any one of those people, that's a general power. If it's limited, it could be a right to appoint anybody in the universe other than myself, my creditors, my estate, or the creditors of my estate. So that's a pretty broad power. Mm-hmm. But because I can't appoint it to myself, it's called the limited power. And the tax consequences are going to be much different between the two.
A power of attorney can have a durability feature, and you would want this durability feature specifically for the person to act on your behalf in case you become incapacitated, because that's generally the purpose of having this power of attorney. We want to have someone who can carry on our affairs for us if we're in the hospital, in a coma, or whatever. So you want to have that durability feature. You can also get a springing power, and in this case, the agent doesn't have any power until some event occurs which springs that power into existence. So you could have a springing power that gives your agent the power at the event of your incapacity. So until you're incapacitated, your agent does not have any power, but then once you become incapacitated, your agent does have power.
To make that springing provision work, usually you have to have some kind of objective test included in the power that will bring the power into being. So a common example might be you need a physician certification stating that the individual is no longer competent to act on their behalf. Then the agent can take over and exercise the powers under that power of attorney.
Now, a power of attorney for property is a very specific type of power of attorney, and this allows the agent to manage the principal's property. You may use something like this if you are leaving town, moving away, and need someone to sell your car. We've had to do this for family members that moved overseas and needed us to sell their car. They gave us a power of attorney specifically to sell the car.
One of the benefits of having a power of attorney is that you can avoid going to court to have a guardian appointed to manage your property if you become incapacitated. Now, when we were talking about wills, we talked about the benefit of having a will because that avoids the intestacy rules. We also talked about the benefit of having other types of transfers that would pass outside of probate, so we don't have to worry about that court process. Well, having an effective power of attorney can do the same thing in a capacity suit where somebody has to manage your assets. So if the power of attorney is effective, you won't have to go to court and have the court appoint a guardian to manage your property in the event you become incapacitated. It also allows agents to sell property if necessary, and sometimes these rights are limited depending on the goals and objectives of that client. Some people don't care. They'll just give their attorney, in fact, the right to sell anything that they deem as necessary because they have complete faith in the ability of the attorney, in fact, to act. But other people might want to say that, well, I really don't want you to sell great-grandpa's gold watch because I want that to stay in the family. So there might be limitations on the ability to sell property when that power is granted to the attorney, in fact.
There are some disadvantages to having a power of attorney. You need to be able to trust your attorney, in fact. You would not want to give this power to anyone that you don't trust, because that agent could then abuse the power. They could act in your name and do things that could end up being harmful to you and to your estate. So you want to make sure that you only are giving it to someone who you can completely trust, or that you limit the power so that they don't abuse it. And then, as we said before, if the agent holds a general power of appointment, then the assets will be included in the agent's gross estate if he predeceases the principal.
A durable power of attorney, sometimes referred to as a healthcare proxy, is really just a power of attorney to make healthcare decisions. Now, this is a classic type of a springing power, where it comes into existence when you can't make those decisions yourself. So typically, as long as you're cognizant and conscious, you have the right to make healthcare decisions concerning your care. But if you're unconscious, if let's say you're in a coma from a car accident and somebody else needs to make those decisions, that's where this power of attorney springs into existence and grants somebody the right to make those decisions for you. Now, this is an important power for a bunch of reasons. One, if you have this power, oftentimes you can get medical care a little quicker than you would if you don't have this power. If any of you have had the opportunity to admit a family member to a hospital, you'll know the process you have to go through. You have to go through this long, extended admission process where you sign all these documents and so on, and that takes time. Well, if you have the durable power of attorney for health care and your physician has a copy of that, then you can get these things moving while you're taking care of that. So your family member is going to get the care that they need at the time they need it. These are always revocable, so you don't have to worry. If you decide you don't like the person that you named, you can always revoke that. And typically, these are coordinated with a living will. If you have a living will, and all a living will is a document, it's usually a letter. It's in the form of a letter that says, to my physicians, attorneys, and those involved with my care, if I'm in a permanent state of unconsciousness, don't take extraordinary measures to prolong my death. Usually, if you have a living will, that's restated in the durable power of attorney for healthcare. So you really want to make sure you trust the person that you give this power to, because literally you're giving them life and death decision-making authority over your healthcare.
As Tom mentioned, the living will, also called advanced medical directives, and I tend to like the term advanced medical directives because living will confuses it, I think, sometimes in some people's minds with a will, and it's not the same thing as a will. But the advanced medical directive is a legal document expressing an individual's last wishes regarding the sustainment of life under specific circumstances. I'm sure that we've all heard of the Terry Schiavo case. This is the document that could have saved the family from 14 years of court battles, because this document expresses what your wishes are if you get into one of these situations where you have to be kept alive under life support, and when you would want to be kept alive under life support and when you would not want to be kept alive.
And the Schiavo case is a good example, because a living will or an advanced medical directive is only effective if you're in what we call a permanent state of unconsciousness. So that means you're not going to recover. You're not going to have any chance of getting treatment and being able to come back. Well, there was a disagreement among the physicians about whether or not Terry Schiavo would be able to come out of the condition that she was in. So because of that, that created this long battle. And if you're a physician and you're concerned about liability, you're not going to pull the plug, so to speak. This is the pull the plug provision. Mm-hmm. You're not going to pull that plug because you're potentially liable. And you need to have authorization to do that. And without court order, it's not going to happen. So this really allows you to express your wishes so that your wishes are taken into consideration in this process.
Now, there is an exception for pregnant patients. So if a pregnant woman goes into a coma, even though she may not have any chance of recovery, the doctors will not pull the plug if they can save the baby. So she will be kept alive until the baby can be delivered. Some states have a registry so that your advanced medical directives will be on file. A lot of hospitals do. I've found lately it seems like any time we have to go to the hospital for some reason or another, they want to know if we have a living will on file with them.
Right, and that's a great point. If you have living wills and you have health care proxies or powers of attorney for health care, you really should give copies of those to your attending physicians. Mm-hmm. So you want to let your health care providers know what your wishes are. And if you have these on file with your health care physicians, you'll typically be able to get treatment quicker and your wishes will be respected.
I mentioned the do not resuscitate order earlier. This declares the principal's wish to avoid having CPR performed in the event the heart stops beating. And you often find this with patients who are terminally ill or very elderly patients who don't want to prolong their life on earth any longer. When they die, they just want to be dead. They don't want people to perform CPR and try to save them. again, you want to have these on file with your medical professionals.
And these are not always available. Part of this depends on state law. Usually you have to be in a very bad physical state in order for this to apply. If you're a healthy 35-year-old who just decides that because you're a little bit depressed, you don't want to go on living, and you're in a car accident, and you tell the doctor you want a DNR, they're probably not going to honor that because the car accident isn't a terminal condition. It's something that they can deal with and they can fix the problem and you can go on living. So this isn't something you can use as a substitute for, if you will, assisted suicide.
Right.
But if you have terminal cancer, if you are very close to death, it doesn't make sense to prolong death. And really, again, this is going back to the same thing the living will does, because it says, let nature take its course. Don't artificially keep me alive just to keep me alive.
Right. Let's finish up here with a case where we have an example of a situation, and then we'll talk about what kinds of issues might be presented in this example. So here we have Bill, who's 42, and Marcia. They have three small children, one child from Bill's first marriage. Well, that's a red flag for me, because I know that the laws of intestacy may not do what I would want to have happen. Bill has a net worth of $200,000. We're not talking about someone who's subject to estate tax here. He has no estate planning documents. Bill's in a serious accident, leaving him comatose. He's already met his health insurance lifetime benefit, so that means that he's out of pocket now on his medical costs. And his costs are between $5,000 and $14,000 per day. Okay, so we have a man who's comatose, high hospital costs that are not being covered by insurance. Let's look at some of the issues here. First, he has no living will, so he has not said, pull the plug in case I'm in a comatose situation. So as Tom expressed earlier, the doctors are going to be very reluctant to pull the plug. So the doctors will be pushing for prolonging life and keeping him on the life support. What this is going to do is it's going to cause a rapid depletion of the estate. That, remember, there was only $200,000 to begin with. Hospital costs are up to $14,000 a day. It's not going to take very long for all of his money to be gone paying hospital costs.
That's right. And the facts of this case, too, are a little bit interesting, because Bill's only 42 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So even though he's comatose from a car accident, that doesn't mean he's in a permanent state of unconsciousness. So if he had a living will and there was no hope of recovery, certainly this would be a way of preserving some of the assets for the family. But if there is a hope of recovery,
right,
the physicians still are not going to honor
right.
the living will. Because that would violate their Hippocratic Oath, and they can't do that. So this is really bad planning. Bill really should have had an adequate medical policy. And this shows you an integration between different areas of planning.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk about insurance planning, one of the most important types of insurance to have is adequate health insurance that's going to cover your needs so you can avoid situations like this.
Right. He also has no power of attorney, so his wife is going to have to go to court in order to take care of his transactions, his property transactions, and so forth. And this is going to cause a delay and a problem with immediate cash needs. If Marcia has to go to court, what if she doesn't have any assets of her own that she can use in the interim to be able to handle things? This is going to create a real liquidity problem for her.
Right. And what if we have three small children, what if she's a stay-at-home mom
mm-hmm.
and she doesn't have another source of income and there's no disability insurance?
Mm-hmm.
We have, again, the insurance issue coming up, and it's a big one in the estate planning process.
Right. And as I mentioned before, that I saw a red flag because it was a blended family. With no will, he's looking at the assets possibly not being distributed according to his wishes because of that blended family situation. He may wish for everything to go to his current wife and children because his child from a previous marriage may already be taken care of through the divorce decree. And yet that would not be the way it would work out in this situation with the laws of intestacy.
Right. And while it's dangerous to categorize anything in terms of a general rule,
mm-hmm.
usually when you have a small estate like this, you want all the property to go to the surviving spouse. You don't want it to go to the minor children, because the surviving spouse is the person that's going to have the continuing obligation to care for those children.
Right.
Even if he wanted to keep the property in his family, it's going to stay in the family, but his wife may not have access to money she needs to bring those children up in the way that they intended. So that's a really bad estate planning result.
Well, this is it for Chapter 2.
So far in the course, we've just covered an introduction to estate planning. We've gotten through a lot of the terminology that you'll see as we move through the rest of the chapters. Beginning with Chapter 3, our next topic, we're going to look at property interests and then the probate process after that. And then after that, we get into some of the tax consequences of making gifts and having transfers at death. So we're quickly moving into the more planning-oriented aspects of this course, and we'll see you in the next section.